Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. Podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Check it out. Today in the show, we're stretching our legs a little bit, looking at a political thriller instead of the usual sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction, YA titles that we normally discuss. Instead, we're talking to the writing team of Smith Henderson and John Mark Smith, co-authors of the new book Make Them Cry, which is a character-driven explosive action thriller about a DEA agent sucked into the dangerous turf war on the U.S.-Mexico border. Friends for 20 years, the story was conceived quite some time ago and was originally meant to be a screenplay, but they abandoned that idea in favor of a novel instead. We'll talk about the long road they took getting this story completed, writing cynically in this day and age, and how they managed to complete this book in a pandemic from different states, no less. Remember, this is a spoiler discussion, so please, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but definitely double back after you've read the book. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Kind of a different one today. We're going to not do the usual sci-fi fantasy stuff. We're going to do thriller, political thriller. And I've also got, this is another first for me in a way. This is a book that was written by two people. And they're a team who've been a team for a very long time, but this is their first book together. And if I'm wrong about that, they'll correct me in a second. The book we're talking about is called Make Them Cry. And it's written by the team of Smith Henderson and John Mark Smith. Make Them Cry, and this is quoting, a stylishly written and relentlessly plotted with heart-pounding car chases and severed limbs for fans of The Border and Jason Bourne. Make Them Cry is an action-packed thriller of unimaginable stakes. Welcome to the show, John Mark and Smith Henderson. How are you guys?
Good.
How was that for the description? Bang on, not even close, good enough. And that's from the publisher, so you know.
Yeah. I helped with that a little bit.
You did. Okay.
You know, it's like it's promotional language, but I think it's definitely. It's definitely a genre book, which we've, you know, it's interesting to like wrap your head around, I think, for a lot of us, at Echo, for instance, they were kind of like, wait, you're writing a book with your friend and you're going to, because my first book was marketed much more as like a literary, you know, debut or whatever. And so this thing was different.
Yeah. This is being touted as your sophomore book, right?
Or our first book.
You're out the debut of the team, but Smith, your second book, 4th of July Creek, being the first. John Mark, we'll talk about, you know, sort of, I'm a big fan of process, so we're going to talk mostly process. But John Mark, this is your first book.
Yeah, this is my debut.
And you are an English teacher at Texas State University. Is that still the case?
That's right. Yep.
And two things I want to ask you specifically, John Mark. Number one, as an English teacher, how is Smith writing? And number two, just tell me about your first, hey man, first novel is a big, big freaking deal. Tell me about the experience, what it's been like.
So answer
the first question first, please.
Okay. Smith really needs to learn how to use the serial comma and how to that spaces go in ellipses. So he has a real punctuation problem. And I'm as a teacher, you realize that you're focusing on global issues. You don't want to focus on anything too microscopic.
So sure.
He gets an A for content.
Okay.
And style, just not punctuation.
Okay.
It's weird. I mean, you know, the fact that this is my debut and I'm, you know, pretty old for a debut author. It's just kind of like the strangeness of my particular journey as a writer. I've written for a long, long time, 25 years. I just never for whatever reason, I was never able to put together a novel that sold. I've written novels before. I've just never been able to sell them. Okay. And then I kind of went on and did, I started screenwriting with Smith and, you know, life, I did different, took life led to different paths and everything, but here I am. And this is my debut, strange as it is to be making a debut with somebody else.
And a good friend too, which helps.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad to share all the, it's cool to share all the workload and not have everything like just be you, like you have to do 1,000 media, you know, appearances all by yourself. It's great to be able to lean on somebody.
I'll bet. And Smith, two questions for you. Number one, do you believe those that can't do teach? And, and tell me, so this, and your sophomore book, that's a sophomore books in the world of publishing is a big milestone. Tell me how that's been for you.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, fortunately, but
don't dodge the first question.
I know. yeah, it's really, really true. I think that, I'm just been carrying John Mark on my back
pretty much
this whole time. And, I just like the company, you know? No, seriously.
It's a pandemic. We're doing whatever we can to reach out. Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
That's
exactly. Right. Yep. Takes it. I, you know, this kind of relates to your second question in a way. I didn't want to work on a book all by myself for a variety of reasons, but foremost, just because I had so much fun working on different things with John Mark. And when we were thinking about this thing as a screenplay or a movie franchise or something like that, it always just seemed like, you know, it was just we had a shorter way to make a real thing. And as ridiculous as it sounds, it was, let's write a book together. And I knew we could do it because he is an incredibly capable novelist and, and I've read his stuff and I was just like, this is a no brainer. Let's just do this together. And so more than his writing though, I think it was just like, I know that I will enjoy your company and you will make this better and we can do it together. And, it won't even be as weird as it probably sounds to people, you know, outside.
I mean, both you guys have a lot of experience writing novels now. It's typically, I mean, you must appreciate that this isn't normal, right? Because typically it's a pretty solitary pursuit. You know, a lot of people hide in a corner, move to a cabin in the woods, whatever, what have you. And, you know, and then they need that aspect of quiet to have their, you know, this thing come to life, right? This idea in their head. So working as a duo isn't normal in publishing. You guys, I'm sure you're aware of that. And the thing is that strikes me is that you guys would have written this separately, pandemic or not, because yeah, you live in different states.
Right.
So talk about, you know, we'll do a little bit of process here. Actually, before we get into that, and you know, that forgetting that quick little summary at the beginning of somebody just take this ball and run with it and give me the elevator version of what Make Them Cry is about. Actually about, forgetting that it, comparing it to Jason Bourne.
it's about, you know, the log line, the really short version is there's this DEA agent named Diane Harbaugh, who's like having a lot of, she's been having a lot of trouble doing her job the way she's supposed to. And she's finally gone crossed enough like thresholds of like sketchy stuff that like she's going to be in big trouble. She's pretty sure. She has an informant who, at the beginning of the book, like does something pretty astonishingly violent, which sheds a lot of light on her. And then this opportunity comes up just kind of out of the blue, this connection she made with somebody in the Mexican cartel, who is now advanced to a pretty high level, reaches out to her and wants to have a private meeting. And normally to do something like that, and we did a fair amount of research into like protocols on this kind of stuff. Cause, you know, you would do it, you would go down with your team or whatever, but this guy wants her to come down yesterday, you know, and she's kind of on the ropes career wise and decides to go down there by herself and enters into kind of a labyrinthine, kind of global conspiracy, that has her dealing with everybody from the cartels to like the State Department to the CIA. And, so we were inspired kind of like by, I think, some of our, like some classic 70s, you know, thriller movies. And I think the thing started for us too, was it was just like, what would be the thing we would want to, if we were like 15 and we wanted to see an awesome, smart action movie or action story that had lots of twists and stuff, what would that be?
One of the things too, so when I've done historically, when I've done ecstasy or mushrooms, I have also written screenplays or come up with ideas. Typically it's like Ghostbusters sequels, animated films about squirrels, right? Like this is, you know, some pretty dire and serious shit. Is this sort of where, you know, not knowing you guys, is this sort of like, you know, the places you hang out at normally, the sort of like the more cynical, darker aspects of the world we live in?
Maybe we don't do it physically, but definitely our mental space is there for sure. At least it is for me. And I think pretty much it is for Smith too. I think you could sort of even say that Smith's first book is like kind of a crime novel, sort of.
Yeah.
So I think that like we are interested in, extreme people, I guess, and extreme circumstances and the people that like live on the edge, whether that's like, you know, the legit people like cops or people in the Demimonde or like Mexican cartels or whatever it is. I think both of us are interested in those worlds. And I think we really wanted this book to have high stakes so that it was like, you know, really something where people died, people got hurt. People were really living in very sketchy situations in a very sketchy world.
The thing I like about stories like this, and again, it's mostly, you know, my experiences with film, but I love it when they, you know, the writer presents incredibly high stakes, and this book has incredibly high stakes, but plays out without most people don't even know anything about it, right? Like the fate of the world, you know, is being decided, at, you know, where most of us just get up and go to work and do our normal stuff. So this, like, all this stuff happens in the shadows, and a lot of that is just, it makes me feel like, you know, this book really reads nonfiction to me because all the events in it probably did happen and probably happening right now somewhere, right? I mean, I don't feel like you guys are stretching, you know, into the fiction realm that much. It just reads very, like I said, nonfiction-y, like almost like I'm reading an account of something that actually happened. Was this based, what, give me some sort of, let's have a little inspiration talk here. What was this based on, anything? I mean, I know sort of the joking about how you guys came up with the idea at that wedding or whatever, but what was it about this particular story? What inspired you to come up with the Diane Harbaugh and the, you know, what she was going to have to go through?
Well, I mean, just real quick, I would say that John Mark on Ecstasy at Tim O'Brien's wedding or not, came up with this pretty interesting concept to me that I latched onto immediately, which was, what if there's like, you know, this company or this entity that sells like some kind of security services or insurance to criminals. And like,
I'm gonna interrupt you for 1 second. So I'm gonna post this after the book comes out, and there's gonna be a spoiler tag at the beginning of it. So
sure.
I'm not, you know, eloquent or smart enough to talk without spoilers. So if don't feel like you gotta you know, color your language or anything.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I was
talking about the concern. You're talking about the concern. Yeah,
that's like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the concern.
I love that name too. It's so funny. Like if you were to tell anyone else that name in any other context, that you'd get laughed at. You're like, what's the name of your gang? The Concern. You'd be like, ah. Or it sounds like a 70s like funk band or something too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Anyways, but yeah, no, so great. The spoilers are all, you talk about whatever you need to talk about.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So we had a lot of backward engineering to have to do to figure out what that actually looked like, you know? And I think the thing where you were saying it feels kind of real was that throughout the process, I was looking for places where it seemed likely that such a thing could have occurred. And for us, in Carver's backstory, the CIA guy that we meet in the book, that's where this thing kind of took off. And I was like, you know, you can go and read like accounts of the war in Afghanistan and see very clearly that the military was partnering with poppy warlords, as they're sometimes called, with different factions there that were entirely like making their business decisions based on whether or not like an A-10 Warthog would come in and blow away somebody for them, you know? And it was like, oh, jeez, that's amazing. And the thing we were also just interested in, one thing we realized really quickly, was that we were combining like genre elements that would normally be discrete. Like you might see spies and, you know, military people together in a book or something like that, but like you wouldn't see too often. I guess James Bond and stuff does this, but it's such a cartoony world. That we were like, oh, the back channels and the ways that people move about in crime worlds and in spy worlds and drug enforcement, interdiction teams and all that stuff, military and even State Department, governmental level people and international bankers. Like we was just like, oh, this all goes in, you know, and let's look for things. And so I'm constantly on the lookout when I'm reading the news and stuff for places where it's like, oh, maybe those two worlds are touching right there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that to me was, I think, realizing like this can have some legs because there's going to be a lot of different realms within realms to explore.
And that's really like, that's the hook really. And we laugh about the concern, but you know, the fact that you started with that idea of an insurer, it's and even Carver explains it a couple of times anyways to different people about what exactly they do. This idea of, you know, yeah, like these cartels needing insurance in a sense to put out fires that they just don't have time to do. And the idea is that this stabilizes not only the market, but the region, and then in turn, the country. It kind of seems to make a lot of sense, right? I don't know. You're like, I remember reading that, especially when, you know, and you guys really do a great thing there where you break, you know, a lot of time jumping, different things like this to sort of get people up to speed. It's a good convergence theme in this, right? Everyone's sort of headed to the same spot. And, you know, you go back to the polygraph sessions Carver had, and where he's really explaining what went on over, you know, in Afghanistan, and you know he sold me on it. I was like, yeah, go do it. Right?
Yeah. That was our thing, was that we had to believe in it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I would just say that he, like, the one of the things that made it where Smith and I thought this was really interesting is that on a sort of global from a global perspective, we think that the drug war has just completely, it's basically like the major world fact since the fall of, you know, the Berlin Wall, that like the drug war has just warped. I would argue that even more so than the wars that the United States has fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, the drug war is like this long, slow version of both of those things that has affected basically every single person that lives in the United States, whether you know it or not, and really like much of the world, if not all of the world. And so, it has definitely affected the United States and Mexico in ways that it is inescapable in people's daily lives. And so we really wanted to explore the ways that the drug war has deformed both policy and then people. And that, like having somebody come up with this sort of neoliberal, like, solution that at least makes sense. It makes sense on, it certainly makes more sense than what's going on now. We wanted it to be, you know, that it was plausible, that it would make sense. Not to say that we necessarily endorse it, but that it does make sense if you think about it realistically.
Well, it's grounded in a lot of logic, right? And that's the thing that's great about it, because it's the same thing with a lot of the wars in the Middle East. Like the U.S., you know, when these countries have one export, and so you want to end the war in the Middle East, then you just cut off that one export. But that's clearly not what the U.S. is interested in doing overall. So what's the next best thing? Let's just try and, you know, keep these guys from really just destroying everything.
Can we mitigate the violent effects of black markets,
right,
by some mechanism? Because you can't call the cops, you can't call a lawyer, you know, you can't sue anybody. But maybe if you had a piece of the rock, like, you would just, you wouldn't go shoot up the plaza.
Sure, right. It makes sense from, like, a mobster point of view, right? Like, you're just things that are common sense, but, you know, the common sense in this maelstrom of violence and drug wars and drug trafficking, not common sense on the playground, right? So different type of playground.
Yeah.
One of the things too, you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago there was, pandemic or not, you guys live in separate states, Montana and Texas. So let's go back and do a little bit of process again. I'm curious, just talk about, like, how you guys wrote, just the mechanics, how you guys wrote this stuff. Were you in charge of different parts of the book? Or did you just, you know, send each other ideas and one person was maybe sort of in charge of putting it down into a more formal idea?
Well, basically the first thing we do, and this comes from our screenwriting together. We started screenwriting in either 2007 or 2008. And with screenplays, the sort of the words on the page are in some ways the least important part. The most important thing is the arc and the beats and the story itself. So the first thing we did is we would spend a long time beating out the story, where we're basically just, like, talking to each other through, it started on iChat and then now we're on FaceTime, where we just talk about it. You know, we plot the whole thing out and we go through all the plausibles and we talk about all the different things that work or don't work. And, you know, I don't know how long that takes. It takes a long, long, long time. And we kept coming back to it. So, we don't start writing until we've basically plotted out the whole thing and figured out all the character arcs and all that kind of stuff. It's never right. Like, it's never been like where we don't have to make changes. We, of course, have to, once we start writing, we figure out, like, what was wrong with our outline and we have to go back. But that's basically the way that it starts.
So when did
the next steps?
When did it start? When was the ecstasy? When was the ecstasy wedding?
So to tell the truth about that, it's really more like idea.
It's just funny. It's funny they include that in my presser, right? Like, it's just like, I'm like, if they didn't want me to talk about it, they wouldn't include it in the thing.
Well, it is true.
Right.
We came up with our partnership writing about crime there.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to say something like that it was a plan to just, like, rob all the people at Tim O'Brien's wedding that we didn't do. That would be really cool if we had planned to do.
And you're like, yeah, we'll need a tunnel. Well, we're going to need a tunnel to get away. And yeah, gotcha. When did this start? When did from the earliest idea to...
Oh God!
Well, the wedding was like 2002, but we didn't start. We didn't really start working, I think, on this until 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. It's been a long time. This has been a long go. Just with this particular, I mean, life gets in the way. You guys have probably left it, come back to it several times, but that's a long go for a book for sure.
It started off as a screenplay.
Right. Sorry. Yes. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, that was just like us. That had us focused entirely on what gets revealed in this book. Right. And what we did when we decided to write a novel was we said, okay, well, let's just take this idea and start a book. And we realized after quite a while that we had written about a third of the book, and we sent it off and we had it all teed up to get published. Right. And then I had this, like, there's something that's not sitting right with this thing, you know? And I always say, like, you know, they'll let you publish a bad book, mm-hmm. you know? Cause I mean, I read them, you know, you see,
yep.
I was just like, oh man, I want to be sure. And I don't know what the deal is. And I fretted about it. I probably went to a wedding and took ecstasy to figure it out. I don't know. But at some point I was like, I just realized I was like, oh shit, we started the book with the wrong protagonist and in the wrong place. You know, we need someone who goes into this world and can like discover it. We can't just like drop people right in the middle of here, because all we're doing is explaining everything.
Right.
And so we needed to have, and I called John Mark up, and I was like, we need to talk. I think we have a problem. And it wasn't like the easiest thing for us to admit, but to his credit, he was like, yeah, I think you're right. And so we were, you know, we were back to the drawing board in a lot of ways.
This is where Diane came from, I assume, at some point.
She was there, but she just didn't have the, she wasn't the protagonist, and she just didn't have the, she was more of an antagonist.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
It's funny too, because, you know, you read this book and then and it ends, and it there aren't any, I mean, she's a protagonist in the traditional sense, but I mean, she's no angel. I mean, she's really hard to like. It's a really, you know, I'm wondering, and you guys would answer this, with the year we've had and everything that's going on in the world, and, you know, it is a cynical story. Is this something you guys think about? Are you thinking like, man, this year's been so awful? I don't even know. Like, did you ever get to a point where you're like, did it become kind of a drag to have to like finish this book? Because I want to talk about the end, and I think it's important. Okay.
Sure.
But we'll get to that, but just sort of talk about sort of just like, you know, when you're in this world and it's not a great world. I mean, there's a lot of violence and there's a lot of horror and people doing bad things to each other. Then you look at the real world and it's a mirror image.
Yeah.
Right. So there's no separation from it. So I'm just curious, just from like your own sort of personal emotional points of view here, like, did you find it, did it become a bit of a drag sometimes?
You know, it's kind of funny, because I had the same sort of, you know, with my first book, I had the same sort of like questions a lot.
Yeah.
People are like, what the hell? They're like, I'm halfway through your book and man. And I'll be like, oh yeah. You know, take care of yourself. Like,
I'm going to call in a wellness check.
Yeah. Yeah. Check in with your friends and family. Just, you know, when we were writing this, I think, you know, it was like everything was perfect. Right. Right. I mean, the world was pretty screwed up, and we could see like these same things were screwed up. And we just thought, like, you know, as much as I agree with you, I think you can kind of see where our where things are going, or kind of like that it's that there's also a sense in this book, I feel, that like that Diane and Carver and everybody else are trying to do something, you know, as outlandish as it is, they're cynical enough to see like nothing really substantial is going to happen on a societal level to stop the drug war, but maybe we can do something that will mitigate its worst effects. So it's cynical, but it's also, I think, like, you know, situational.
Yeah. I don't, cause I didn't read them as righteous enough to do that. What I read it as, you know, you do the best with what you got, and and they're just maybe no good at anything else.
Right. That's totally. I think there's truth to that too. That's what was really interesting to me in all of this is what, you know, how much can your soul bear each of these characters, you know, can one of them, you know, Tomas is really interesting. He's also,
I love Tomas. We'll talk about Tomas. Don't jump ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But you know, so they're human, you know, but they really do, extraordinary things that are very questionable. And that's the kind of thing we were talking about earlier. That's what we're interested in.
I mean, the lodestar for that stuff is just all those 70s, those paranoid 70s thrillers. I think both of us it may just have to do with our age. And it's like, those are the movies that seem the coolest when we were kids. Just like 3 Days of the Condor or something. Like, it felt like a cool adult world. Like, when I was a kid, it felt like it was like the secret. This is like the secret way that everything actually is.
Right.
And I think that that's something that drove us, that it's like, we didn't want to present we didn't want to present a Pollyanna-ish view of the drug war, because we feel like we owe it to tell, even though this is fiction, we owe it to tell the truth about the absolutely horrific, incalculable cost of these policies that have been enacted for, you know, like, I don't know, pretty close to, I guess, 50 years now, because Nixon started it something like 50 years ago.
Well, yeah, or you could even go back 100 years if you want to blame the Mormons, but, And again, and you're right. And like, there's bloodied hands on both sides of the border. Right. And you're right. There has been for a very long time. And again, to your point too, like, when I said they're not righteous, it doesn't mean they don't have limits and some type of moral compass. I mean, even Carver, I don't remember exactly the line, but at one point he says, we don't do slave trading or
human trafficking.
So it's a quick little line.
But that,
so even it tells you, okay, he's only willing to go so far. And Diane clearly has morals and limits. Now, at the end, she's entering a world where, you know, morals and limits are sort of a debilitating quality to have when she makes her decision at the end there. Talking about the ending now, happy ending, ?
that's right.
For sure, there's tons of room left there, and even just the idea of the concern is great. I mean, it's almost like you could almost, if you I'm sure I could see like an executive saying, well, we're gonna soften these edges a bit, we're gonna make them more like the A-Team. And you that'll drive you guys crazy, and they'll buy the script from you, and you'll just have to go somewhere and pout about it. But even though Diane's decision is a scary one, and it's maybe not what you want for her at that point, then you read it, and then you're done, and you sit with it for a bit. But then you start to think about it, and you start to realize, you know, that's what her happy ending looks like. Because when you live the life that Diane has led, Kinko's might as well be a prison.
Right. Oh yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
And I mean, and no offense to Kinko's and the people that work there, but
our lovely sponsor Kinko's,
of course, which are wonderful people. But I doubt the people working there right now haven't led the life that Diane Harbaugh has led. Yeah. So that is really tough for her. And then you think about, you're like, you know what, you know, fuck me. That's the only decision she could have made. There's what's the alternative, right? I mean, everything she's is trapped, falling apart. She was looking at literal prison and then up until then Kinko's. So it's like,
it's
like, God damn it.
She's like she's a woman of action, you know? And when you do like our, I think
just not 10 toes, too, just not 10.
Yeah. Toes. Yeah. Minus a few toes. Yeah. And you, when you behave like that, when that's your orientation to the world, you do a lot of things that you know, other people wouldn't do,
right.
Or that aren't really, you know, what you should even do, but you do them and you write it out. We, you know, it was hard. I mean, I'm worried about her, you know?
So am I. Yeah. It's just like that lovable mutt, you know, like you just, you're like, you just, you want her to make the right decision at least once.
Well, and you know, that's the thing is like, I really love characters who have reasons, good reasons for doing something
that bad things,
ultimately yeah. makes things worse, like, yeah. or just further complicates things. It's so, sure. so great. It's such a fun thing to encounter in a story.
Is that sort of, was there any major differences between the screenplay sort of however far you had that mapped out and then the novel? Did anything change?
Oh yeah. I mean, basically
like major, did anything major? What was give me a couple of major things that changed?
Well, but Diane took over the story basically. Like we realized, I think there was probably like a sense that I don't think we were like, when we were writing the screenplay, it was like more like Matt Damon is going to play Carver. And we were sort of thinking about that. Right. Once we stopped doing that, Diane became the most interesting character and she took over the novel. So I think like her just emergence was something that made the story much, much better. And it's what Smith saw. He didn't totally see it at that point. He just knew something was wrong and it made it, we had to scratch. So that that changed from the screenplay. Carver was the protagonist. He was still the protagonist in the early draft of the novel. And then in this version, he became, you know, what he is now. So that changed. We also started where the concern was already, I think almost every version we had, I'm pretty sure the concern was, we started much later in the evolution of the concern. Like it was already an enterprise that was working up and running completely in all the versions of the script.
Okay. Yeah. That would have just probably eaten up way too much page. I think the way you did it,
yeah.
it was totally fine. Speaking of Carver, one of the things that, you know, he's always on the lookout. He's always looking for new recruits. And you know, of course, and again, spoiler alert, he recruits Diane at the end. And but somebody else he recruits is Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet him actually in the U.S. He's there because he's a Sicario, essentially. Not essentially, that's what he does. And our poor, sweet little boy turned evil. And all he wanted to do was play D&D. And this stupid people started calling him El Frodo, which is hilarious, by the way. And then is this intentional? He's El Frodo, and then we meet him. He's hanging out with someone named Sam. Is that on purpose, Lord of the Rings, or no? I don't know. Because Sam's just as annoying as Sam in the movie, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And, you know,
I never thought about that. That's
you
amazing.
Didn't? No, I'll bet. No. And
crap,
anyways.
That's so cool.
Sam's this just appropriating white guy who's just awful. And but he does have a good line, and it's sort of a little, it's meta. You know, he says, quote, "See, I don't read nothing fictitious, nothing somebody just made up." And I was like, all right, that's a nice little, nice self-deprecation on the writer's part. Anyways, this is where we meet Thomas. And he's just a great, great kid. And, you know, he goes through a rough go, and he's connected to, you know, this other group that he works for, and his boss, El Rabioso. I always love when there's a, you know, a film or a book or whatever, and it's of a serious nature, like a violent organization or a mob,
yeah.
but they sort of comically have to deal with like, you know, like mid-level management headaches.
Right.
Just like the
gears. Oh yeah, we love that too.
Yeah, just like the gears of running an operation, and you know, like, and there's a couple scenes with him on the phone, right, with El Rabioso, which I thought were really, really great. Talk about Thomas though for a bit, like sort of where he comes from. He seems really specific to me. Like, you really make sure that we understand where his sensibilities lie. He loves, these great fantasy novels and he was raised on them, but then he had to like toughen up, right? Because he lived on the streets basically. And talk about sort of his arc.
Go ahead, Joe Mark. I'll just say, I feel like, we don't do a lot of this kind of forensics of like, did you come up with that or did I or whatever? But I feel pretty strongly like you were the one who was like, he's really into Dungeons and Dragons and fantasy.
It's just funny because in the opening scene with him where he's trying to read and Sam keeps bugging him. That's how I feel when I'm trying to read. Like I'd want to shoot. I want to shoot somebody. Like I'm like when I'm trying to read and someone's bugging me, I'm like putting plastic on the floor, and planning what I'm going to do. Sorry, but yeah, he's really great character. He's just really specific.
I'm not sure if I can remember exactly the origins. I think that Smith and I are both interested in it's really interesting when a character is a striver in an interesting way. Like the way that Tony Soprano was like always into history or something. Like it's like he comes home and he watches World War II history in The Wire, Stringer Bell was like art collecting or something. Like mm-hmm. it like these things that you wouldn't expect, but that are obviously like very real in real life. But that people don't necessarily think of when they think of, gangsters who are, of course, obviously like real people with real interest. They're not just interested in money and power. I think it was like that we wanted something that he did or was interested in that we could also that we could connect to his sense of being a knight, that it was like, I want to live in a world. And that, tell the truth, that may have come from Tony Soprano too, where it's like Tony Soprano, he's like my world at the very beginning of The Sopranos, he's like, my world used to be better. Like the men were honorable. Mm-hmm. We had something to fight for and now it's all over. And Tomas kind of is going through the same thing. It's like, he wants to be a knight with honor, but there are there's not knights with honor in right. his business. And that's his journey that is of course connected to his love of fantasy and just reading in general. Like he's addicted to reading basically.
Right. Right. And also shirtless warlocks and stuff too, but that's a different, that's a whole different issue. That kind of currency doesn't travel very far down in the Mexican cartels apparently.
No, it doesn't.
He's like a lot of the characters too, where, a lot of people in life feel trapped, and when they feel trapped and they feel like their options are low or non-existent, they're oftentimes they break and are forced into just situations they don't want to be in. And I feel like that's very much Thomas, right? He's, when we meet him, it's like he's already sort of disenfranchised.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And right.
That only becomes more so. And then at the end, it's like, and correct me if I'm wrong, he just sort of accepts that there's really no getting out of this world, but I can make the best of it. And this Carver guy is offering the best deal at the moment.
I would almost say that if there's a missing scene in the book, it might be Tomas like kind of thinking this thing might be honorable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. This might be where he belongs.
Sure.
Which is kind of, the arc for Diane too.
Right.
But he definitely has that, I would say negatively, where he's like, I'm done with the cartel and I'm done with I think he sort of has a negative epiphany about that. And then he, what else does he have to do except for join up with Carver?
Sure. Yeah, Diane again too. Same idea. Like she's usually the one on the other side of the glass, right? Making these people understand that their options are they've run out of options, and you have no choice but to work for us now. And she's now finds herself on the other side of that glass with Carver, and it's a great. I love the way you break her down slowly. She's always in her head saying, "Should I tell him this?" And then she tells him. right? Like she instantly regrets it, but then tells him more stuff. Like, it's like she can't help it the same way, you know, she, you know, that was her ability for so many years, right? With people like poor Oscar.
Yeah, she's looking, she's looking to be, and this is stuff I'm really excited to explore more, but she's looking to be, to have a profound life, mm-hmm. you know, like to put it in the most grandiose way. It's like, cause she, you know, she had powerful positions or ones that could become more powerful, but she just like couldn't stem the tethers and the compromises involved in those things and was so goal oriented and just frustrated. Cause it just, she could feel the systems that she was involved in not working.
And she, and she's got, like, there's a track record there of poor decisions, you know, whether it was spending too much time with Oscar or getting maybe too close to intimate mm-hmm. with her boss, and then poor Bronwyn. It's just like, is still texting her from somewhere. So it's like, you know, it's like she's got the receipts of, you know, not necessarily a life well spent, but to your point, she's, you know, I think, and the same with Tomas, with Carver's presenting this option here of maybe something we can do. If you're going to continue down this path, at least make it count, I assume.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, guys, a couple minutes left here. And anyone listening, we haven't even really touched on this thing. There's so, like, I mean, Gustavo just like pounding cocaine the whole book. And and there's some incredible action set pieces too. You know, the setup Carver does and the ambush, and incredible set piece. You know, if that ever makes it on the celluloid, that'll be something special for sure. You know, as things reveal themselves to this mystery, like I said, it's all about convergence. They all are, all these people are just ending, you know, driving forcefully to the same spot, and poor, you know, and nobody gets off clean here, and everybody walks away with a scar or two, except maybe Carver, actually. He's so goddamn handsome, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, he's the golden boy.
Yeah, I guess he's the Labrador retriever, and then everybody else is just pugs or something. But he's pretty untouchable for most of the book, but everybody else walks away with either a limp or something. So a lot of books would have given people a redemptive arc in a way, and but you guys don't. You stop short of that, I think. You know what I mean? It's like it's like, you know, Diane ends up in a better spot maybe for her at that point in her life, but listen, don't be jealous of that lifestyle. I mean, it's not like she's, you know, you don't want to trade places with her still, but you definitely
she's chosen a life of like of being kind of a wanted person, you know, an outlaw, like kind of. It's like, you know, with sort of a Robin Hood mentality about it or something, you know, but still, like, it's not going to be an easy life.
Well, and by her own admission too, she's about to be, you know, she's looking for vengeance, right? So like, she's looking to take that dude out who took her toes. So it's going to be an interesting thing to, you know, if the story continues, if you guys are able to write more about it, that'd be great, because it'd be interesting to see, you know, how this sort of team works together, how Carver's able to sort of like manage all the pieces. And
I just shared some stuff with John Mark like this week.
Oh, cool.
It's over. Yeah, it's fun.
I'll bet. Yeah, no, you guys, and that's because you guys have created a good base here, right? A great world to, you know, for these characters to exist in, and that's important, obviously. So it's good to hear that you seem inspired and excited to keep going. So that's great news for everybody. So
it's been awesome to talk with you today. Because, you know, you read the book when we got to talk about the book so much. It was great. I really appreciate it.
I know it happens. Mm-hmm. It's been out there. I know people, I would never, and I'm not like, I'm definitely not a hero, but I would never talk to somebody about a book without reading it. That's not cool.
It just gives you the opportunity to get to like, reflect on what you did. I mean, just from an author's point of view, it's pretty, it's pretty great.
Well, it's a lot. It's, you know, I really like, I do really appreciate process. And I mean, that's all of it, right? I mean, that's what this thing is process. Once the book's done, it's out in the world. It ends up being a, you know, on, you know, either a placeholder for somebody's cup mm-hmm. or something else, right? So that's sad to say, right? And so, but so it's the process, and you guys spent in a lot of years, more longer than most people do writing their books, and you know, you're so invested in it emotionally, and I mean, think how much your life has changed in the, you know, since you guys started this story in your own lives. I mean, it's got to be insane. So I always, you know, I'm very, very curious about process, just because it's such an emotional process for you guys. And I know it's a big deal when this thing, you've already had one book out, but getting this out into the world and letting people read it and get to talk about it, that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks, Steve-O. We really appreciate it. You've been absolutely great. Terrific.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Again, thanks, everybody. Make Them Cry comes out on September 22nd, hardcover and ebook, however you choose to read it or buy your books. I personally don't like to give money to the scary bald guy. you guys have any places you'd like them, like folks to buy your book?
Your favorite book? Local bookstore.
Any? Okay, so
give them a call. We'll say
Bookshop. And if you don't know what that is, bookshop.org is a really great place to go. They are sort of like a broker for independent bookstores all across America. Guys, thanks so much. Fingers crossed for November. We'll see what happens. And then when Make Them Cry 2, Bronin's Revenge comes out, we'll touch base again when that comes out.
All right,
guys.
All right, cool. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything's Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to both John, Mark, and Smith for taking the time to speak with me. A couple of great guys there worth supporting. And if you like a good political thriller with some pretty great character work, I think you'll enjoy this story immensely. It's a violent, high-stakes fate-of-the-world type of story, but buried beneath the sharp edges are definitely some round corners. Make Them Cry is out now, so pick it up wherever you buy your books. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to CineLinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Bye for now. Bye.